We continue this evening our series of studies on the seven deadly sins, and tonight we come to the sin of gluttony. Having already dealt with pride, anger, envy, and last week, lust or impurity. The sin of gluttony. A certain rich man fared sumptuously every day. That would be the text if you wanted a text. Now, a number of reactions present themselves when this subject is broached. First of all, it might be thought that here is a subject of limited application. For in any gathering such as this, would there be many, we think, for whom this is a living issue? Then again, we might ask, what could be said about this subject that is not already obvious? Besides, we go on, are we really to class this alongside the sin of lust or impurity that we were dealing with last time? That, we can see, could be deadly indeed, and a killer. But this? Now, I say these things because they're the kind of reflection that might pass through our minds when we put a mental question mark over against this deadly sin, gluttony. But let me remind you over against that of one or two points. The medical authorities state that one of the commonest nutritional disorders in Great Britain is obesity, caused by habitual overeating. Let me remind you that this is something particularly relevant in our affluent society, a society in which we're repeatedly told, and not without reason, in the material field, that we've never had it so good. The words in the parable Jesus taught, the rich man fared sumptuously every day, are very relevant. And let me remind you also that the food you have already eaten today is more than millions in other parts of the world will have to eat for all of next week. What we eat in one day. These are statistical figures, easily obtained. What we eat in one day is more than millions of people will have for a whole week. And to complete the picture, listen to this letter written by Screwtape, a master devil to an under devil engaged in the destruction of souls. My dear Wormwood, the contemptuous way in which you spoke of gluttony as a means of catching souls in your last letter only shows your ignorance. One of the great achievements of the last 100 years has been to deaden the human conscience on that subject, so that by now you will hardly find a sermon preached or a conscience troubled about it in the whole length and breadth of Europe. This has largely been effected by concentrating all our efforts on the gluttony of delicacy, not gluttony of excess. Your patient's mother is a good example. She would be astonished, one day I hope will be, to learn that her whole life is enslaved to this kind of sensuality, which is quite concealed from her by the fact that the quantities involved are small. But what do quantities matter, provided we can use a human belly and palate to produce querulousness, impatience, uncharitableness, and self-concern? Bluebows, this is another of the underdevils, has this old woman well in hand. She is a positive terror to hostesses and servants. She's always turning from what has been offered her to say with a demure little sigh and a smile, "Oh, please, please, all I want is a cup of tea, weak but not too weak, and the teeniest, weeniest bit of really crisp toast." You see? Because what she wants is smaller and less costly than what has been said before her. She never recognizes as gluttony her determination to get what she wants, however troublesome it may be to others. At the very moment of indulging her appetite, she believes that she is practicing temperance. In a crowded restaurant, she gives a little scream at the plate which some overworked waitress has set before her and says, "Oh, that's far, far too much. Take it away and bring me about a quarter of it." If challenged, she would say she was doing this to avoid waste. In reality, she does it because the particular shade of delicacy to which we have enslaved her is offended by the sight of more food than she happens to want. The real value of the quiet, unobtrusive work which Glubos has been doing for years on this old woman can be gauged by the way in which her belly now dominates her whole life. The woman is in what may be called the all-I-want state of mind. All she wants is a cup of tea properly made, or an egg properly boiled, or a slice of bread properly toasted. But she never finds any servant or any friend who can do these simple things properly, because her properly conceals an insatiable demand for the exact and almost impossible palatal pleasures which she imagines she remembers from the past. A past described by her as the days when you could get good servants, but known to us as the days when her senses were more easily pleased, and she had pleasures of other kinds which made her less dependent on those of the table. Meanwhile, the daily disappointment produces daily ill temper. Cooks give notice and friendships are cooled. If ever the enemy, that's God, introduces into her mind a faint suspicion that she's too interested in food, Glubos counters it by suggesting to her that she doesn't mind what she eats herself, but she does like to have things nice for her boy. In fact, of course, her greed has been one of the chief sources of his domestic discomfort for many years. Now your patient is his mother's son. While working your hardest, quite rightly, on other fronts, you must not neglect a little quiet infiltration in respect of gluttony. Being a male, he is not so likely to be caught by the all-I-want camouflage. Males are best turned into gluttons with the help of their vanity. They ought to be made to think themselves very knowing about food, to pique themselves on having found the only restaurant in the town where steaks are really properly cooked. What begins as vanity can then be gradually turned into habit. But however you approach it, the great thing is to bring him into the state in which the denial of any one indulgence, it matters not which, champagne or tea, sole or cigarettes, puts him out. For then his charity, justice, and obedience are all at your mercy. A minor sort of sin. Well, Dr. Lewis says that if you think it's a minor sort of sin, they've pulled the wool over your eyes too. That by way of introduction. What is gluttony? Well, we've seen in our studies that some sins are intrinsically evil things in themselves. And others are the perversion of something originally good and God-given. Lust, we saw last week, was the perversion of something originally God-given. And gluttony is the perversion of something that is normal and God-given, namely appetite. It is not wrong to eat. And it is also not wrong to enjoy eating. We must eat to live, as the saying goes. But when we get to the stage of living to eat, then it is sin, and we've made a god of our belly. Now, I think the value of that quotation from Lewis is that it pinpoints the subtlety of this particular sin and shows how gradually and imperceptibly it takes hold of someone. Now, I want you to think with me this evening about one or two scriptural examples which make this point. Will you turn with me, first of all, to the book of Exodus? The book of Genesis, I beg your pardon. Genesis chapter 27. At verse 1. And it came to pass that when Isaac was old, and his eyes were dim, so that he could not see, he called Esau, his eldest son, and said unto him, My son. And he said unto him, Behold, here am I. And Isaac said, Behold, now I am old. I know not the day of my death. Now therefore take, I pray thee, thy weapons, thy quiver and thy bow, and go out to the field, and take me some venison, and make me savory meat such as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat, that my soul may bless thee before I die. Here is Isaac, one of the patriarchs, the son of faithful Abraham, the friend of God. And he's now an old man. He is the promised heir of the covenant. And in the direct line of the promise that ultimately was to bring forth the Redeemer. One of the strategic and prominent figures in biblical history. And a type of Christ. And here he is in his old age. Nearly blind. And feeling in himself that it cannot be long now before his pilgrimage is ended. And in this state and at this point in his life, on the very borderline between time and eternity, all he can think of is the savory meat such as his soul loved. A complete preoccupation with food. This is what the old scholars meant when they spoke of gluttony as a deadly sin. Would you like to think that with one foot in the grave, so to speak, you would be preoccupied with your belly? As this man was. Take me some venison and make me savory meat such as I love. the man who was the heir of the promises, about to stand before the great judge of all the earth. And yet his mind is on foot. And he goes down in the sacred record as a man who, almost on his last gasp, was thinking of food. Now you see, this doesn't happen overnight. This is the fruit of a long history of indiscipline and loss of self-control, which, as we're told in the New Testament, is the fruit of the Spirit. And you can see from this, you see, how essential all-round control is in the spiritual life. What does it avail if we guard ourselves successfully against lust and impurity? And thank God it is possible to guard oneself by the grace of God against lust and impurity. But what does it avail us if one form of unbridled appetite is kept under iron control, while another form of unbridled appetite can express itself in such indulgence? This is the point in this series. There's a sense in which it's all wrong to take one at a time, because Christ saves a man from all sin. And Christ's salvation is the only thing that can put all-round control upon a life. And indiscipline in one department can never be compensated for by iron control in another. If we sin in one, everything is gone. I knew a man once who took a good deal of, I suppose, pardonable pride and satisfaction in having been able to give up smoking cigarettes. He was a heavy smoker, and he really cut it out. But he was a man who just could not stop eating sweets. Now you see, that man wasn't saved from sin. His sin changed from one thing to another. The essential indiscipline was there. Here then is Isaac. Now, the tragedy about this is that it has its effect all round in a man and lowers his general resistance and usefulness. Isaac very nearly frustrated the purpose of God and was like to give God's blessing to the wrong son because of this. You see what has happened? His spiritual perception has been blunted. He has no longer the awareness of the will of God and the purpose of God. God had said at the beginning, "The elder shall serve the younger." And yet, Esau was about to get the blessing. And this is the sinister thing about indiscipline. It blunts one's perception, not in that particular thing only, of course it does that, but all round. He that striveth for the mastery must be temperate, self-controlled in all things, says Paul. All things, not merely in the one thing. And there's a very real sense in which we're starting at the wrong end of the thing if we concentrate on one particular form of temptation that is bothering us. The answer doesn't lie there. The answer lies in the heart. All round discipline, all round control, all round crucifixion. It's that that gives strength and virtue for the various aspects of life. The answer to temptation to any particular sin, like the sin we were dealing with last Sunday, for example, is not concentrating our prayers on that thing, because that can very often just accentuate it and drive us inward upon ourselves. We must go to the heart of the problem. The self-discipline and self-crucifixion in there that sends its beneficent virtue right out to all parts of the being. You remember how Samson, who was an indisciplined glutton in another field, likewise nearly ruined God's purposes because of his sin. Now, as I say, this sin, like any other sin, is not seen in its seriousness in one isolated act. One act of gluttony may soon be forgotten or pass unnoticed, but it's the accumulation of acts over the years and the continuous habit that develops, unknown, like this woman and her all-I-want syndrome. That's what reveals the attitude of heart, and that's the thing that matters. Isaac did not and could not have fallen into this sin suddenly. You know, sometimes folks say that you can't be too hard on old people. After all, their faculties are not what they used to be. I wonder if we realize what a slur that is on some old people. All old people do not become indisciplined. The old people that become indisciplined are people who have always been indisciplined down the years. A man doesn't suddenly become a glutton. An old man suddenly doesn't become preoccupied with food. That's the end product of years of indiscipline. Perhaps secret indiscipline, secret yielding, secret indulgence. Those who have been indulgent all along are the ones who appear, and certainly, obviously, when old age comes, when faculties are impaired, then the weakness, the basic weakness, will be seen. But it's not the fruit of old age. This has got nothing to do with old age. What it's got to do with is self-indulgence all along the line. And of course, it's always the attitude of heart which says, it will do no harm this once. Maybe no. But it never remains this once. That's the trouble. That's the first step on the downward slope. Listen to these words. Written by a brilliant figure in the literary life of our land of a former generation. A man who ended in utter disgrace. He wrote these words in his confession. The gods had given me everything, but I let myself be lured into long spells of senseless and sensual ease. Tired of being on the heights, I deliberately went to the depths in search of new sensation. I took pleasure where it pleased me and passed on. I forgot that every little action of the common day makes or unmakes character, and that therefore what one has done in the secret chamber, one has some day to cry aloud from the housetops. I ceased to be lord over myself. I was no longer the captain of my soul and did not know it. I allowed pleasure to dominate me. I ended in horrible disgrace. Well, of course it was predictable. That's always the end product, sooner or later. You know, the words, sow a thought, reap an act. Sow an act, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character, reap a destiny. That's why it becomes harder and harder for a man as he goes on and as he grows older to break with the past, to start afresh with Christ. Harder and harder. Whether we're dealing with the sin of gluttony or any other sin. And that's why it's better to come to Christ at the outset of life and not leave it. And leave it, and leave it. But that takes us on to the sin of sloth, and that must be reserved for another time. Now follow Isaac's history a little more. You remember the story of his two sons, Esau and Jacob. What did Esau do? Esau, we're told, sold his birthright for a mess of pottage. His god was his belly too. And you could hardly think it would be any different. After all, look at the father that brought him up. You know, it's all very well for a man who may be very conscious he has made a mess of life to wish that his son might never go the way he has gone. But if that father continues in the mess and fails to come to Christ for healing and cleansing and salvation, then by his very example he's encouraging his son to take the same road. And that's why Esau went that way. And although his father had tried and succeeded, it may be, to keep some kind of control, Esau didn't, and dispensed with his birthright, and opted for a material way of life altogether. This is the tragedy, and this is one of the frightful consequences that follow not only this sin, but any other sin. There's an entail of sin. We could take numbers of instances from the scriptures. You remember the story of Belshazzar? Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords. And the sin of gluttony and debauchery carried that dissolute monarch beyond the bounds of control and he suddenly let everything go and committed the sacrilege, desecrating holy things, that brought the writing on the wall. And that was the end of him. And there was the rich man who fared sumptuously every day. And I wonder if you noticed in that parable what is written between the lines. What's the impression you got of this rich man? It wasn't that he was a bad man, or a dishonest man, or a crook. It's the thoughtlessness of the man that appalls us. The beggar sitting at the gate, and every time he drove out in his chariot, there was poor Lazarus lying there, begging for the crumbs, skin and bone, like some of these pictures we've been seeing of Biafrans in the press lately. But he was absolutely thoughtless and insensitive to human need. The hardness of heart. This is the terrifying thing about this sin and about any other sin. This woman. Think of that poor overworked waitress. What would she have thought about Madam? And her fastidiousness. Let us remember this, my dear friends. It's not expressions of enormity in sin that we're dealing with, but the kind of thing that goes on in restaurants, in Mackey's and in Crawford's, in Edinburgh and every other place, every day of the week. This is the kind of thing. The sin of gluttony. Whether in its fastidious expression or in its more gross form. Oh, the thoughtlessness, the self-absorption, a complete preoccupation with her belly. And in hell, he lifted up his eyes, being in torment. Now there's so much one could say on this subject, and one could go into doubtless harrowing illustrations and so on, but this is not our point and purpose. I said enough to make all the point that I need. But this is the important thing. We can't come to Christ and be saved from the sin of gluttony only. Because this is only one factor in the total human situation in which we're involved. Christ saves from all sin. And the fundamental premise of the scriptures is this, that in sin and because of sin, our whole nature has been tainted and corrupted and vitiated and broken. And all manner of lawlessness abounds in our lives. This is why it's so completely beside the point to give up smoking cigarettes if you're still a slave to the sweet tooth or the pleasures of the table. This is why it's so completely beside the point to concentrate on these individual things, individual manifestations, as if giving up cigarettes would mean a man was converted. There are men in hell tonight who never smoked a cigarette in their lives, and yet they've perished. Let's be sensible. Let's be intelligent. Christ doesn't come to us to help us and to allow us to exchange one sin for another. He comes to us to save us from ourselves and save us from our sin, to impart a new heart and a new nature, to place a mighty hand upon us, to subdue these lawless, renegade instincts that have usurped authority over our minds and over our thinking and over our conscience. That's the point. And that's why it begs the question to try to reform oneself concerning this sin or that sin or any other sin, gluttony, lust, or what have you. It begs the question. It is a matter of handing over life to Jesus Christ and allowing Him to exercise control. The fruit of the Spirit is self-control. And the Spirit comes when we bow the knee to Jesus Christ, and in no other way. And when He comes, it is not only one sin whose power He breaks, but all sin. He gives a new heart and a new spirit. He makes us new men. Men in whom the God-given instincts, whether of appetite or any other, are in their proper place. And those powers and virtues that are meant to have the rule in man's life are also in their proper place, exercising authority. You see, this is the prospect of Christ's salvation, making men whole, making them men. You see, a glutton isn't a man. He's not even a beast. He's subhuman. A lustful man is not human. We sometimes say he's beastly, but the beasts don't act like lustful men do. You see my point? Christ makes us men, real men, and that's salvation. And the thought that Christ could make a man of you, or a woman of you, a real man, a real woman, is, it seems to me, a wondrously attractive program. And this is the offer of the gospel. Nobody said it was easy. But in a true sense, all we have to do is to come to Him and let Him take over. Because unless we do, at one point or another, we're going to be enslaved, and we're going to be broken, and we're going to be lost. There is no other alternative. Christ or loss, eternal loss. And it's ours, by His grace, to choose. Let us pray. O Lord, Thy word exposes us We would hardly have thought that our fastidious pleasure at the table could be called by such an ugly name as gluttony. Lord, help us to be honest with ourselves, and help us to face the truth of thy word. And O Lord, for those who feel the plague of sin and know the enslavement and bondage and misery of habits, that their own conscience and mind abhor as well as condemn, may it be theirs to know, gracious Lord, that thou art able to save to the uttermost them that come unto God by thee. We ask this for thy great namesake. Amen.